It's 11 o'clock, and to go ahead and keep things rolling, because we have a full agenda in this program today, I'm going to go ahead and get started. First of all, I'd like to welcome everyone. This is Trends and Innovations in Living Donor Transplantation. This session is sponsored by Fujisawa. If you're looking for hypertension and aneurysms, not like you're really looking for those things, but I didn't say if you want them. It's a session in the Washington room, which is just right around the corner here. The ARPKD session is in the Lincoln Roosevelt room. Be sure to complete your session evaluations and leave those as we go out the doors here. We'll pick those up on the way out. We still have time for the questions and answer boxes. Is everybody finding those okay if they've got the questions? You can write them down. We've got little cards in front of them. There's one on the end of the PKD Foundation table. There's another one up here by where you registered and got your name tag. So if you've got questions, write them down, stick them in the box. Need to do that right after this session, because after that they'll cut them off so they can start answering questions for everybody. Be sure to wear your name badges, especially to lunch today, because that's going to tell everybody what you've got. Your little tag on there tells everybody what flavor you're having for lunch, so make sure you wear that. And that is about it for our announcements. What I want to do here is I'm going to introduce a couple of people as we go along and then get down to the meat of the program. So we're very excited about this session. It's a new one for us, but then again, the program's new too, so we're excited to bring it to you. As many of you know, a transplantation is a treatment for kidney failure, but it's not a treatment for PKD. So we want you to know that, but it is something that's a very exciting program, and this is a relatively new transplant program that we've got that we're going to talk about here from Dr. Montgomery. So we wanted to bring this to you and talk to you a little bit about it. But before I introduce Dr. Montgomery fully here, I'd like to introduce two of his PKD patients. Judy Bowen has been an active member of the PKD Foundation for many years. She's currently the chapter coordinator for the Washington, D.C. chapter, a member of the chapter advisory committee, an ad hoc member of the Board of Trustees Governmental Relations Committee, and Judy has represented the PKD Foundation at local health fairs and last year won the award for the best educational seminar. Last year at our annual conference in Minneapolis, Judy was struggling with dialysis. And after that event, Dr. Montgomery performed an ABO-incompatible living donor kidney transplant on Judy. For those of you who don't know what that means, Judy was fortunate enough to have a friend offer her a kidney, but Judy and her donor friend do not share the same blood type. Dr. Montgomery will tell you a little bit more about that special procedure during his presentation, but right now we'd like to take this moment to thank Judy and recognize her. She's responsible for Dr. Montgomery's presence here today. Thank you, Judy. Another one of Dr. Montgomery's patients is Sharon Sullivan. Sharon contacted the PKD Foundation because she was working on a unique project she felt might be useful in helping raise awareness of PKD. But rather having me tell you all about that, we invited Sharon here to tell you a little bit about that herself. Sharon?
Thank you, Dave. Well, 1 week ago, June 3rd, I had a transplant, so it's been over a year. Dr. Montgomery has this brand new program out, or is fairly new, that has made it possible that I'm here today. I would have died. I was very, very ill. I was in the hospital almost every single month and had serious problems. Nobody matched me. I had more than 80 people test. So if any of you out there ever needed a kidney and needed, had people test and didn't match anyone, well, he's the right person. He has this innovative program that really works, and because of that, I'm here today, and he's going to make it possible for the many people that could never get a transplant to have an opportunity for a second chance of life, and it truly works. I'm here, living proof, okay? And I also, because this was so important to me to educate the public about organ donation, what's new in transplantation. I'm a television producer, and I produced a documentary on my story, which was very, very difficult because there were many compromising situations. But I wanted to basically show what is new and what is available to the public. And most people, when they are on dialysis and they're very ill, they don't have the wherewithal or the interest to do the research. So most of us are visual by nature, and if we can watch something and learn, it'll give us an opportunity to find out what's out there. And I hope that you can
you know, everybody here shares the information that they learn from Dr. Montgomery and tell other people that are on dialysis or need a transplant that there is hope and there is a program that works. And he is the one that is responsible for this program. Now I'm going to show you a clip of this documentary.
I can't do this much longer. And this is very hard on my body. I just can't do this.
Sharon Sullivan is dying. She has lost both her kidneys and desperately needs a transplant to survive. But Sharon is no ordinary transplant patient. A series of tragic circumstances would cause her body to reject almost any donated organ.
It's been impossible. I've had more than 60 people tested, and I've not had the perfect match.
Her only hope is a procedure so dangerous it breaks all the rules.
We're violating a lot of the principles of transplantation.
The procedure itself could kill her, but Sharon has nothing to lose. Sharon's mother and siblings had donated blood for transfusions during her first transplant surgery. Sharon had developed antibodies that would attack her family's blood and donated kidney, causing instant rejection and likely death. Instead of being her best match, her loving family was now among her very worst. And a lifetime of medical procedures had left her with so many antibodies that she would reject a kidney from almost any donor. Sharon was what's known as a sensitized patient, nearly impossible to match. Just when Sharon was so close to death that the search seemed hopeless, fate intervened in the form of an unlikely angel.
I heard about this particular program at Johns Hopkins, so I looked into it and came here.
It's an experimental program specifically for patients like her with impossibly high antibody counts. Pioneered by Dr. Robert Montgomery, without it, Sharon's body would never accept Brian's generous gift.
We sort of become the Supreme Court of kidney transplantation. People come here when they're kind of at the end of the line.
The procedure is called plasmapheresis. It passes a patient's blood through a machine that filters the antibodies out of the plasma.
What's unique about this particular procedure is that we've combined that with a cocktail of drugs, and in particular one drug that seems to stop the antibodies from coming back after we remove them with the plasmapheresis.
But Sharon's antibody count may be the highest Dr. Montgomery has ever seen. Dr. Montgomery now begins an operation that breaks all the rules of organ transplantation. Sharon has beaten impossible odds just to get here, but this is the biggest gamble of all, and it's off to a rough start.
It's been kind of tough going because the liver is so big and the spleen is really deep.
The two-part procedure typically takes 9 hours, beginning with a splenectomy to remove the spleen that harbors antibodies. Dr. Montgomery manages to complete the first phase successfully while keeping Sharon's blood pressure in the safe range.
Now we're going to start the kidney transplant. Now the lifeless kidney is going to turn pink again. See it? And is going to come back to life. I never get used to it. You know, never get tired of it. Always a magical time when that comes off. You have to realize that taking care of these patients is like handling a spitting cobra. You never know when things are going to get bad, and they can get bad very quickly.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
They make it look so easy, don't they? Just Sharon, thank you very much for that. That was a wonderful documentary. And Judy, thank you too. I know that probably all have a lot of questions, and Judy and Sharon will be available after this session to talk to you if you'd like to talk with them a little bit further. Since you've already heard a lot about him here, and it's time to meet Dr. Robert Montgomery. He's the Associate Professor of Surgery at Johns Hopkins University Medical School. He's also the Chief Division of Transplantation Surgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, and the Director of the Comprehensive Transplant Center in Parkland, Maryland. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Dr. Robert Montgomery.
Thank you very much. Well, we're going to sort of multimedia you to death here today, but I wanted to show this clip that was featured on the Today's Show, which talks about a slightly different part of this product line, essentially, that we're offering at Hopkins now to try to get difficult to match people transplanted. So bear with me for this, and then we'll start to talk in a little more detail about these various procedures.
This morning on Today's Health, new hope for the tens of thousands desperately in need of a kidney transplant. We'll meet six pioneers, three donors, and three recipients in a moment. But first, more on the revolutionary new medical procedure from NBC's Fred Francis.
Dr. Robert Montgomery is a medical revolutionary, a star transplant surgeon at Johns Hopkins.
Take good care of him.
Last Sunday, he and a remarkable team made medical history, transplanting three kidneys from donors who did not know to whom they were giving an organ.
Guys ready?
In an extraordinary surgical choreography, six operating rooms functioned simultaneously. Healthy kidneys snipped from donors rushed to those who might die without one.
We've never done anything like this. But we've built up to this, and it is possible to make these swaps.
The team is using new procedures and pre-operative techniques that will radically change the way kidneys are transplanted, saving thousands of lives. This will be Mike Mooningham's fourth transplant, made possible only because the hospital has developed a technique that cleanses harmful antibodies from his blood. Over 55,000 people like Mike are on dialysis. A third will reject most kidneys. Mooningham has spent two-thirds of his life on dialysis, a terrible existence, knowing he'll eventually die.
Every day's rough, and it's hard for me to get rolling, but I'm just glad to be here today.
Now, with the new ability to erase harmful antibodies, any recipient with a live donor can get a new kidney.
I love you. Thank you so much. I know it's going to work. I know that thousands of people are going to be transplanted as a result of this.
Mooningham's donor is Kathy Mahoney, his stepsister. The Oakland teacher knew her kidney would not go to Mike, but to another critically ill patient in the triple swap surgery.
Medically, I can live a perfectly healthy, normal life with one kidney.
Dr. Montgomery, whose team took 7 hours Sunday to complete the historic feat, is creating a national computerized list of live volunteer donors.
If all the patients who had live donors in the country entered this pool, we could transplant virtually all of them.
Example, Sean Moyer and his wife Alyssa, both medical doctors.
See it. Kidney's here.
Sometime this year, the medical establishment is expected to endorse Dr. Montgomery's revolutionary vision. For today, Fred Francis, NBC News, Baltimore.
Dr. Robert Montgomery and his SWAP team are with us from Johns Hopkins. Good morning to you all.
Good morning.
Dr. Montgomery, the SWAP in it itself is extraordinary, but talk a moment, if you will, of plasmapheresis, this procedure that essentially stops the body from rejecting the organs. Will this necessarily mean that everyone will be eligible for a kidney transplant?
Well, in a sense, yes. Plasmapheresis is a technique whereby we can remove harmful antibodies from the blood of patients. And it's those antibodies that produce these incompatibilities. So essentially, with this technique and the swap, we feel very strongly that we could transplant virtually anyone who has a live donor.
Well, we want to meet the folks with you. In fact, the patients with you were just transplanted on Sunday. They don't know who gave them their kidneys, and I don't want to let them wait any longer. So, doctor, will you tell us who helped whom?
Sure. I first want to just say that this is a very private moment, actually, that our patients have decided to share with America. And I think they're doing that because they feel so strongly about this. So, Kendall, this is Kathy. And Kathy gave you her kidney. And Alyssa, this is Mike.
Hey, sweetheart.
You have Alyssa's kidney. And Rick and Sean, they share tissue now.
Mike, you've had, this is her fourth transplant. What do you say to Alyssa?
Thank you, Lisa, big enough. And I just don't know what to say because it's my fourth transplant. I didn't expect to get another one. And these guys here at Hopkins are really miracle workers.
And Alyssa, you couldn't give to Sean, but you elected to enter this pool. Tell me why and give me a sense of what you're feeling right now.
I think it's a fantastic opportunity to help not just my husband, but a great guy like Mike.
And Kendall, you just learned who your donor was. What are your thoughts?
Signal for me, no hope whatsoever in existing on dialysis, which is not an existence to, future and my everything. All these doors, it's amazing. It's just amazing.
Kendall, how did you feel when Dr. Montgomery introduced this concept, this pool, to you and also talked about the plasmapheresis?
Well, what I was hearing from all of the other transplant centers was that there's nothing we can do for you. Your antibodies are too high. We won't be able to find you a match. And
well, we're so happy that the match has been found for all of you. We wish you all the best.
Don't you love television? The producers were really upset, actually, that we didn't get Katie Couric. She wouldn't have ever done that. All right, so let me see how to. So, thank you all so very much for inviting me to speak with this group today. It's a very important group. I take care of a lot of patients with PKD, and it's really an honor to be here and to take part in this. It's now very clear that renal transplantation is the optimal therapy for end-stage renal disease. And if you look at just about any category of patient, those who get a transplant on average live twice as long as patients who stay on dialysis. So the blue bars are patients who receive a transplant, and the darker are those who stay on dialysis. And this, I think, has really sort of revolutionized our thinking about transplantation. Unfortunately, this next slide follows the first one. And this shows the number of patients in need of a transplant versus the number of organs available. And you can see that patients who are waiting for transplants are rising in an exponential manner, whereas the cadaveric or the non-living donor pool, which is represented in the dark bars here, has remained pretty static over the last decade, and that's despite a lot of effort at education and a lot of money that's been spent on public education. The hatched bar represents the number of transplants from live donors. And it's my belief that that's our hope for the future. And in fact, if you extrapolate this line out to the year 2010, the average patient is predicted to take 10 years on the waiting list in order to get a kidney transplant, unless something changes in this dynamic. Now, what are the advantages of a live donor transplant? Well, there are many. I mean, I don't want to suggest that kidneys from non-living donors are in any way compromised, but there are very clear advantages to a live donor, and I think principally is that this is a organ source that can expand, whereas it doesn't appear that we will be able to grow the non-living donor pool very much. There's a shorter waiting time. Obviously, if you have a live donor, you can be transplanted almost immediately. The kidneys tend to work immediately. Patients who receive a live donor kidney generally have a shorter hospitalization, shorter recovery period, and the kidneys tend to last about twice as long. And also, a live donor frees up a kidney for another individual who doesn't have a live donor who's waiting on the cadaveric list. So we looked actually in the mid-1990s very carefully at why people weren't donating, why they made the decision not to donate to a loved one. And there were a number of different reasons when we did our questionnaires that came up as the most significant reasons. And one of them was just the sheer magnitude of this operation. And I don't know if there are any donors in the room, but the incision used to be very large. It wrapped right around the abdomen. A rib was removed. It was a really great undertaking. So the pain involved, the length of hospitalization, the cosmetic results, all these things were all these things worried potential donors. And then the recuperative time, the convalescent period, was known to be very long. And when you have a donor and a recipient who may be spouses, that has a very dramatic impact on the family to have both of those people recovering from a major operation. And those who are self-employed or have child care responsibilities found this to be quite a burden as well. So at about the same time, there was this revolution going on in minimally invasive surgery. And several of us at Hopkins started to think about the possibility of applying some of these same techniques to the donor operation. And at the time, this was pretty revolutionary because the donor operation is so unique because you're taking an individual who doesn't need an operation and putting them at risk. And so the field was very conservative about changing anything. So this was the same operation that we've been doing for 40 years. But we raised the question, if we could change the magnitude of the operation, maybe we could remove some of the disincentives to donation. And I've really kind of already outlined what those were. And so in February of 1995, we performed the first laparoscopic donor nephrectomy. And you'll see that this is a kidney in the donor right here. These are the laparoscopic instruments. So the whole operation is done through these very tiny incisions. That's a stapler that just came across the renal artery, and now the stapler is coming across the renal vein. And we're putting the kidney into a bag, believe it or not, and then we pull that bag out through a small incision in the abdomen. And this is essentially what the incisions look like. There's a small incision around the belly button. There's a small incision over here and just below the ribs. And then we pull the kidney out through an incision about that big down below the bikini line where a C-section incision would be made. And I often comment when I'm pulling the kidney out that it looks a lot like a baby's head coming out. So did this achieve what we had hoped? And I think the answer is yes, it did. When we looked at our first 110 laparoscopic nephrectomies and compared them to the open procedures that we did during the same period of time in the mid-1990s, you can see that the length of hospitalization for the patients who had the laparoscopic procedure is about 2 to 3 days, where it was 5 to 6 days for the open. And people are now returning to work in 2 to 4 weeks after a laparoscopic procedure, where they used to be out for 6 weeks to 3 months with the standard open procedure. And people started to believe us, and this has caught on like wildfire. And if you look at worldwide now how the donor operation is done, you can see that between 99 and 2002, the majority of donor operations now are done laparoscopically, and this continues to increase. Another significant innovation that came about this, in the same period of time when we were starting to do the laparoscopic nephrectomy is the 3D CT scan, which gives us a beautiful roadmap. So here's the kidney right here. That's the spine of the patient. And believe it or not, this is a CAT scan, and you can see the renal vein here. And it looks just like it did when we actually put the camera in and did the laparoscopic procedure. So we used that innovation to help plan our operation. Now, again, in the same sort of theme of trying to increase live donation as the answer to this huge gap, we started to look at other reasons why people weren't being transplanted with live donors. And perhaps the most significant barrier, and the barrier that Sharon was up against, was that about 30% of the now about 58,000 patients who are waiting for a transplant have become sensitized. And what that means is that because of a previous transplant, a pregnancy, or a blood transfusion, they have been exposed to another human's tissue. And in certain instances, when you're exposed to tissue, your body forms antibody or forms an immune reaction against that tissue. And so, again, about 18,000 people are in this situation where they're very difficult to match. They wait disproportionately long periods of time for a match. Women are disproportionately affected because of pregnancies. And if we did a transplant in the face of these antibodies, the kidney would be immediately rejected. Now, we developed this test in the late 1960s, which allowed us to determine if a patient harbored these harmful antibodies. Normally, we think about antibodies as being something good. In this case, they're harmful. And essentially, the test is that we take serum or blood from the potential recipient, and we mix it with a potential donor's cells. And if these cells get killed, then we know that there are these harmful antibodies. And so every patient who gets transplanted has a cross match done, and that's what Sharon was referring to. She had somewhere between 50 and 80 donors come forward, and when we did this test on every one of them, her body attacked the cells. Now, this has a very potent effect on your ability to be transplanted. PRA, which some of you may have heard about, is sort of an indirect measurement of how sensitized you are, how many different tissue types you've seen. And if you take everyone in this room and match, for instance, Sharon's blood against everybody in this room, she would respond to greater than 80% of them. And if you have a PRA of greater than 80, your chances of getting a live donor kidney are less than 3%. And unfortunately, for the last 30 years or so, this group of patients has been largely ignored. And they've kind of been put on the cadaveric list and told that it'd be unlikely that they would get a transplant. And these patients have continued to accumulate. Now, what's the actual problem? Well, if you look at a cross-section of a blood vessel in the kidney, okay, and you have these cells, and on the surface they have these molecules, and these antibodies recognize these molecules, and these molecules are unique to various individuals. It's sort of our signature. And so if you just look at garden variety antibodies, the good antibodies, they just pass right by these molecules. But these bad antibodies that come from the pregnancies, transfusions, or previous transplants will bind to them. They trap this material that's sort of like spider silk, and then that traps platelets, and pretty soon the blood vessel gets clogged and the kidney dies. And that's what one of these kidneys looks like. It starts to turn black virtually right on the operating room table in most cases when this has occurred. So along comes plasmapheresis, and this is a plasmapheresis machine. It looks somewhat like a dialysis machine, and the experience is similar to a dialysis machine. The plasmapheresis actually filters out these harmful antibodies. Then we come in with a drug that I referred to in the video called IVIG, which prevents the antibodies from coming back, and then we use several other drugs. And in some cases, we do a splenectomy, which was mentioned in Sharon's story. And the spleen is where these antibodies live, and so you essentially take their home away. I just want to sort of a public service announcement. Just I've seen a lot of PKD patients in this program, and the main reason that they've come to me sensitized is because they've had their native kidneys out, and that frequently requires blood transfusions because it's a big operation. The kidneys are very big. Or they've had some cysts resected from their livers, and they've gotten blood transfusions and developed these antibodies. So it's something that you have to be very careful about if you're a PKD patient. I usually will tell my patients not to get their native kidneys taken out before their transplant, before they go on these suppressive drugs, because it could affect their ability to get matches. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we have sort of a product line in terms of what we can offer patients. So once we initially evaluate the patients and determine whether or not their incompatibility is amenable to plasmapheresis, removing the antibodies, we also ask them if they're interested in a paired kidney exchange. And a paired kidney exchange is a way of swapping kidneys around so that you can get a better match and a negative cross match, which a negative cross-match means you don't attack the cells of your donor. And we have in the instance, the Today Show clip, there was one patient who received plasmapheresis who had such high levels of antibody that we wouldn't have been able to get rid of those antibodies to his original donor. But by bringing another donor into the picture, he had much lower levels of antibody against that donor, and so we were able to combine the swap with plasmapheresis, and this opens all sorts of possibilities. So let me just talk to you briefly about paired kidney exchange. Now, when this concept first arose in the mid-1990s, it was hotly debated in our field. People were very concerned about the ethics of somebody giving a kidney to a stranger in order to get something in return for their loved one. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and then there was a period of a couple of years where it was debated in the field, and ethicists, clergy, everybody who had an opinion sort of entered this controversy. And in the end, it turned out that there was a consensus that this was ethically sound. And so I think there was a feeling that this was going to have a huge impact on transplantation. But when we actually sat down and looked at the numbers in a sober fashion, it turned out it probably wasn't. And the reason why is the way the paired kidney exchange is done conventionally is that you have two pairs, two donors, two recipients. Each of these, you know, comes forward together. So this is usually a loved one, and you would have a donor who's a blood type A and a recipient who's a blood type B, and the A couldn't give to the B because of an ABO incompatibility. This is a different situation. So Sharon and Judy are sort of the two examples of the two types of antibodies. There are different flavors of antibodies. Sharon has antibodies against tissue, and Judy has antibody against blood group of her donor. They both produce the same effect. They attack the kidney. So this A couldn't give to this B, and so you would pair them with the opposite incompatibility, where you would have a donor who was a B and a recipient who was an A, and they couldn't, the B couldn't give to the A. But if you swap the kidneys around, then you get a B giving to a B and an A giving to an A. Seems like a great idea. Problem is that these blood types are the rarest of the blood type combinations. And of all the potential donor-recipient pairs out there, it only affects about 3%. So we started to try to think a little bit outside of the box, and we had all these patients who were coming to us because they had antibodies against tissue, what I described earlier as a positive cross match, or because they had a blood type incompatibility with their donor, and we started looking at ways to mix and match them together. Now, the reason why the conventional swap only affects the A's and the B's and the A's is that if you put an O, the most common blood type, in any of the four positions, suddenly it only benefits one of the two pairs. And I'll show you what I mean by that. Let's say that we have a donor who's a blood type A, and they have a recipient who's an O. This is the most common combination. And the A can't give to the O because they're blood type incompatible. Now, an O can only receive a kidney from an O because of blood type incompatibility. And so this recipient would need to have a donor that was a blood type O. O's can give to anybody. So that O would give to their loved one. So while it would benefit this pair to have this person give to that person, that's not human nature. Well, for most of us. I'll tell you a little later about a unique group of patients where that's the first thing they think about. But anyway, so this would benefit this pair and not this pair. Now, however, if this person had harmful antibody against their donor, then, and didn't have antibody against this donor, well then, suddenly you've got a swap that works for everybody. And that's the sort of thing that we've been doing. This is the first triple swap that we did just over a year ago that also got some attention nationally. And we had two sets of patients. All three of these pairs came to us separately. We had two sets of patients that had positive cross matches or antibody against tissue, and then we had this pair who were blood type incompatible. And what we noticed was that this woman who had a PRA of 100%, so she would have antibody against everybody in the room, so she's essentially untransplantable, was a perfect match with this woman. So she was like, when her body would see this woman's kidney, it was like seeing her own tissue. And so this was a very unusual set of circumstances. So we started to build the swap around that exchange. However, unfortunately, this woman was a blood type B, and this intended recipient of this woman was a blood type A. So we fixed one problem, created another. So enter this other couple who were blood type incompatible. They were engaged to each other. And this woman was quite ill from her kidney disease. She was blood type B, so she could receive this kidney from this woman. And this gentleman was blood type A, and he could give to that person. And so by exchanging the kidneys around, everybody got a blood type compatible kidney, and everybody got a negative cross match. Now, this last swap illustrated here that was on the Today Show, again, we had three pairs who came to us separately. And believe it or not, they had such high levels of antibody against their intended donors that we couldn't remove it by plasmapheresis. It was too high. But by exchanging the kidneys between them, we got two of them to a negative cross match, so they didn't have any antibody against that donor. And we got one down to a very low level of antibody that we knew we could get off by plasmapheresis, and that was Mr. Mooneyham, who's the gentleman who's getting his fourth kidney transplant. And so we did that swap. Now, for those who we can't put into a swap, who we can't find a good match in a swap, and now even for those who we trade up to a better immunologic situation, if you will, where we know we can remove their antibody with plasmapheresis, they see this. And both Judy and Sharon had this procedure. So essentially, we set a date of transplantation, because remember, they all have live donors. And then we determine how many of these plasmapheresis treatments they'll need, and that's based on the level of their antibody against their donor. So in this cartoon, I've indicated that this imaginary patient would need five treatments. The treatments occur every other day. PP stands for plasmapheresis, and IG is this medication that we give to prevent the antibody from coming back. So five treatments, we go to T-minus 10. We start doing these every other day treatments, and on the off day, they get their dialysis. We give them some immunosuppressive drugs, Prograf and Celcept. And then we give them this new drug that's out, which essentially limits the response of the cells that produce antibody. And then in some cases, we do a splenectomy on the day of transplant, add a couple of other drugs, and then we do plasmapheresis treatments afterward. After this last pheresis treatment, patients on the same drugs as any of our patients, they suddenly become like our other patients who don't have an incompatibility. So all the treatment is right around the time. So we've now done about 72 or 3 now, but this is these are the data from our first 62 patients who had the positive cross-match type, like Sharon did. And you can see that most patients only require about 3 treatments before and 3 treatments after. The survival of the kidneys at 3 years is about 84%, which is very good. It's pretty similar to what it is if you don't have an incompatibility and you get a live donor. And the mean follow-up now is about 2 years on these patients. And out at 3 years, they have fairly normal creatinines. So things look very good. Now, we've added the splenectomy and this drug that I mentioned in sort of the middle of our series. And this is very interesting, because if you look at the first 42 patients that we transplanted, this is the survival of the kidneys, percent survival, over the number of months out from transplant. And you can see that you do lose some kidneys. As I mentioned, at 3 years, the graft survival, the kidney survival, that's not the patient survival, but the kidney survival is 84%. But with these new drugs that we've added and doing the splenectomy on patients who we think are very high risk, we have 100% graft survival in the second half of our series. So now we'll move on to the second most significant barrier to utilization of a live donor, and that's blood type incompatibility. So if you look to your left, the person who's sitting next to you, you have a 36% chance of being blood type incompatible with that person. So one-third of the potential donors that are brought forward by our patients are blood type incompatible, and traditionally they've just been ruled out. They've never gone beyond that first test, which has come up that they're incompatible and can't donate. And again, it's the same problem. It's just a different flavor of antibody, but it has the same consequences. Add to that this bit of information, and that's that if you have blood type O or B, you wait on average twice as long for a kidney transplant from a non-living donor. So we've got this group of patients who are sitting up here who are waiting longer, and it's the bulk of the patients because blood type O is the most common. So we thought, well, that's all seems very unfair and not right, and you know that needs to be changed. Well, actually, the Japanese had been at this blood type incompatible transplantation for about a decade before we did our first one in the United States, and they had been doing it because brain death is not recognized culturally in Japan, and so people have had to rely on live donors only. So there hasn't been an option for the most part for cadaveric donors. So they started doing this in the early 90s. There were a few transplants that were done from ABO incompatible donors in Europe and in the US in the 80s, late 70s and 80s, but they didn't do well. They pretty much universally failed. But the Japanese kept at this and really produced very good results. So if you look at the survival of the kidneys against the years out from transplant, you can see that, unfortunately, there's this loss of kidneys in the first year. About 20% of the kidneys were lost in the first year. And they were almost all lost because the antibodies came back and attacked the kidney. But once you got out beyond that first year, you had an excellent chance of having the kidney last a long time. And so we really concentrated our efforts on this first year. How can we improve that? And we came up with a protocol very similar to the one you've already seen, which involves plasmapheresis. It involves these drugs and a splenectomy and treatments after the procedure. And we have been able to get excellent results. We've now done about 20 of these. This is a report of the first 17. And we had one patient death, which was a very strange thing. A patient died from West Nile disease. But aside from that, the graft survival has been 100%. And we've been at this now for almost 6 years. Now, this report that came out in 1985 from Europe, where they had done a handful of blood type incompatible transplants, showed that people did well when they had a splenectomy, but if they didn't have their spleen out, they lost the kidney. So the Japanese did splenectomy right from the beginning, and all their patients essentially got splenectomies. Well, we said to ourselves, well, there's this new drug out now that essentially does something very similar to a splenectomy, but it doesn't last for a lifetime because there's a downside to getting your spleen taken out. It does leave you somewhat more vulnerable to infections, particularly when you have immunosuppressive drugs on top of it. So we said, well, maybe you don't need to do the splenectomy. This is all based on, you know, 3 or 4 patients. So let's look at this again. So we gave this drug to our last 7 or 8 patients and didn't do a splenectomy. And the results were excellent. These are the creatinines, which, take my word for, are normal. And some of these patients are out over a year. So it doesn't appear that you need to have the splenectomy, which was one of the major barriers, I think, for both referring doctors and for patients. Now, we still do the splenectomy in very high-risk patients who have antibody against tissue, because the antibody against tissue seems a lot worse than the antibody against blood. And so those patients have to get more protection from the antibodies coming back. Now, I'm just going to end by mentioning this other innovation, I guess, that we're just really beginning to understand. And these are these unusual people who first came to our attention in September of 1999 when we had a woman who was a transplant coordinator from the Midwest who heard one of us talking about the laparoscopic nephrectomy. And she came up to us after the lecture and said, "I've been thinking about this for a long time. My kids are, my last daughter just went to college. And I want to give my kidney to anybody who needs a kidney." She said, "I don't know anybody who has end-stage renal disease, but I want, you know, I've got two kidneys. I only need one. I want one of them to go to somebody now rather than, you know, leaving it up to chance when I die whether I'll be a donor or not." And she said, "This operation has, that's what I needed because I'm working and, you know, have a lot of responsibilities. Now I'm ready, now that this is there." So we did her transplant in September. The next day we got 77 calls because it got picked up by the media, people who wanted to donate their kidneys to anyone. And to date now we've had 250 people who have been interested. Now a lot of them don't go beyond that first phone call. But we have done 10 transplants now from these so-called altruistic donors. We've been giving, allocating these kidneys to children because children are really the most profoundly affected by kidney disease. They don't grow, you know, either physically or socially, or they have significant impediments to growth, I should say. And we're about to have a consensus conference that I'm going to be directing in the fall of 2004, where we're going to try to better understand these people and how to better allocate the kidneys. We know now that we've had 250 people inquire about this, and we've only done 10 of the transplants, and I think we have a very high bar. Everything has to be so perfect in order for us to accept one of these people. And perhaps that's not fair to them that we have raised the bar so high. And so we're going to be talking about all these things as a field and coming up with guidelines. We're also having a similar type of meeting about the paired kidney exchange, because I believe that if we could nationalize a list, and it was mentioned in the video clip, that we could exchange we could get most people transplanted with an exchange rather than plasmapheresis. But there are logistical barriers, there are financial barriers, there are administrative barriers, none of which I am willing to accept that to prevent this from happening. And so, you know, the biology is all fine, the medicine is fine, it's just a matter of getting the field in line. And so we are having a consensus conference about that as well, and I'm just starting to try to raise money for that conference. So if PKD Foundation is interested, we want to try to move forward with that and try to move this to the next logical step. So in summary, there's a I've gone droned on for a long time. There's a crisis in organ availability, as we know, and there's a relentless increase in the need for life-saving organs. Live donation appears to be the best hope of closing that gap. Significant breakthroughs that I've mentioned, both in technology and ethical constructs, are fueling what I believe is a revolution in transplantation. And I think that these breakthroughs have led to a lot of innovative approaches that we've been very interested in, and just getting these people transplanted so they can get the benefits both in terms of lifestyle and longevity from a transplant. And some of these that I've mentioned are the laparoscopic donor nephrectomy, paired kidney exchange, positive cross-match desensitization, ABO-incompatible transplantation, and altruistic donation. Now, I'm the one who's standing up here giving this lecture, but in fact, there's a huge team of people who are responsible for this body of work. And these are some of those folks. It's a very labor-intensive, requires a huge amount of resources that my institution has been willing to bet on me to be able to pull this off. And if you look at our last triple swap, the one that I showed you that was featured on today's show, there were 60 staff members who were involved in those six operations. And we had to do it on a Sunday so we would have, you know, everyone available who needed to be available. Most transplant groups are not willing to, or not able to, for the most part, not able to muster up that sort of level of resources. Anyway, thank you for your attention. And if anybody wants to ask questions and you want to stick around for a few minutes, I'm happy to answer.
Thank you. That was fascinating. Thank you to Dr. Montgomery. Thank you to Sharon. Thank you to Judy. I think it's just some fascinating, and this is the type of thing that we want to tell you more about at these conferences. So it energizes all of us. But thank you to everyone that was involved. I'd also like to thank Fujisawa for sponsoring this session. Be sure to complete the conference or the evaluation forms for this session if you wouldn't turn them in. Our next event is lunch. It's always important, isn't it? Please be seated in there at 12:15 with your name badge on, visible, so they know what you're going to have, and that's in Regency E and F. And again, this is your last opportunity to submit questions. If you have those, stick them in the boxes that are around in the other rooms. So thank you for that. We'll see you all at lunch, and thank you again to you folks, too.
That was fascinating.
Good.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.